I think at its core, this conversation today with my guest Nikos was a conversation about philosophy and nature and science, and really trying to make sense of all of it, to distinguish where does one begin, where does the other end. And in so many ways, this was just a beautiful example of the types of conversations I live for. Deep thinking, trying to understand at a first principles level, what is this world we live in? What are we as humans? And what does it mean for how we're supposed to act, how we're supposed to live, how we're supposed to treat each other? As just a bit of background, my guest Nikos is a philosopher. He has 2 master's degrees and a PhD. He works with a number of different people, organizations, individuals, trying to get them to understand the power of philosophy. But really, as he says it, trying to bring fresh, unique insights that are really untapped as a cultural resource so we can unlock some of this ancient wisdom, the traditions, all these different things that will allow us to live better lives, to be better off as a society. And as we do on this show, we spent a lot of time trying to understand that, trying to understand what is this ancient wisdom? How do we know that it's as valuable and as useful as we think it is? What does it actually teach us about humanity? And again, where is that line between just the inherent nature of what humans are that we cannot change and this other piece of us that can grow, can adapt, can evolve? Really, really interesting conversation with Nikos, one that I enjoyed thoroughly, and I hope you guys do as well. So with that, let's get to the conversation. All right, Nikos, thank you so much for being here. Really excited to talk to you today. I appreciate you making the time. I like to get right to it, save time for the conversation, so I will, and I'll ask you what's the value, the belief, the perspective that's important to you.
Wow, that's a great question, and I just want to note that that's an inherently philosophical question. There's no way you could do this podcast without the importance and value of philosophy itself. And so one of the things that's important in my work is just to bring this out, that you can't have a dysfunctional culture without dysfunctional philosophy driving it. So we have this thing that sometimes people call a polycrisis. It looks like even if you don't believe in climate change, you know that there's a lot of pollution in the water, in the air. We got plastic in our blood. We have a political circus. We have all these issues that are going on. And this polycrisis is really just a philosophical crisis, because philosophy is how we do things. You can't make any value judgment without that philosophical perspective. It doesn't matter who you are. You don't have to be a professional philosopher, but if you're a parent, you have a decision to make about what's the way to do that. How do I parent my kid? How do I be a good friend? How do I be a good citizen? How do I do my job? Anything we do, we have to decide how we're going to do it. And that is our philosophy. And that includes what we claim to value. That's a philosophical judgment. And so what's the value of philosophy is it's the thing you can't step out of if you're a human being. We are always going to do things in a particular way, the way we think is the right way. And that reflects a philosophy of life, or at least a philosophy in a context. But of course, we have a philosophy of life too. So the value of philosophy is that you can't step out of it. If you ignore it, you create all kinds of problems, not only for yourself, but for the world. That's why it's not just that I'm a mess if I make bad decisions from a philosophical perspective. It's that other people are going to carry that burden.
So how's that? So I totally agree. And it's very much the reason I asked the question of what's the value, because I think use philosophy, use value system, moral compass. We could pick different words and they do mean different things, but we all have one, whether we recognize it or not, whether we're conscious of it, whether we admit it. There's something that guides everything we do throughout life and the decisions we make, the decision to be on this podcast, the decision to eat what we're going to eat after this. All of it is driven by some value system. If you go down and drill to the root of it, there's something there that tells you this is how I determine the actions I'm going to take. But for a lot of people, as I'm sure you've run into, that can start to feel very abstract. It doesn't feel practical. It doesn't feel tangible. And I think that's part of the disconnect. People, when they hear philosophy, when they hear value systems, it feels like something very distant. It doesn't feel real to their day-to-day lives. I'm curious, like, how you think about that. I'm sure you've run into it with people. How do you try and take everything we're talking about here to start the conversation and make it feel real for people, where they say, oh, okay, I understand what I can do tomorrow, what I should do tomorrow, how I should start thinking tomorrow to try and improve on some of these things, try and help with these crises?
That's such a good question for so many reasons. One of them is that we have to understand, first of all, that this is part of the immune system of the crazy. Okay, if you're caught in a pattern of insanity, the pattern can't maintain itself without an immune system. So it's not like a random thing. Well, we just happen to think philosophy is abstract and that values are abstract. No, the system can't perpetuate itself if you didn't think that. If you did, because then you stay away from it. You say, oh, philosophy, that's over my head. I don't have time to get philosophical about this, guys. No, you are getting philosophical just in that gesture. It's the philosophy is the end of abstractions. We don't realize that we're embedded in abstractions that we take as so real. Abstractions about what I am. Most people wouldn't be able to say what their mind is. They use it every day. It's a completely abstract thing. The body's abstract. Everything's abstract. And so we're missing our life all the time because we're in fantasy land. And we even have gotten to the point that I think one of the beautiful things about it is that our politicians will tell us that reality is not realistic. So if we say we got to clean up the river, well, that's not realistic. Really? Because we got to drink water. So this is the level of abstraction we get, that we buy that story, that it's not realistic to take care of the ecologies that we actually depend on. And then we're meant to believe that this is all a delusion or somebody's making money. I've never met a scientist who said, yeah, I got rich saying the river's polluted. You can't believe how much money you can make saying the river is polluted. It doesn't exist. So what we can begin to do is first recognize that when we're embedded in a system like this, it has an immune system, and we are not going to be conscious of the ways we're acting out things that are not really our ideas. And eventually we want to stop just living our ideas about life and start living life itself. So philosophy is really about ending these abstractions. And it's very concrete things like, well, you have to slow yourself down. When I work with clients, I tell them, you know, even there are three places where you can begin to let philosophy intervene, because you can't do something different until you recognize the crazy thing you are doing and stop doing it. If you don't have the awareness that you're doing it, you can't change it. One of the stories that is for me a touchstone of this is a beautiful story. Oliver Sacks, the famous physician who wrote about people with different kinds of brain disorders. And, you know, he wrote a book on music. He was a very intelligent, interesting guy. But one of his books is called The Man Who Mistook His Wife for a Hat. Guy had a brain disorder and he really was seeing things improperly. But the story that stands out for me is this man comes in to Oliver Sacks's office and he's leaning over. He's got this lean that Sacks said, I can't believe he was upright. You know, I mean, he's like the Leaning Tower of Pisa walking in. And so I know what's wrong. He's clearly got something going on. And the guy says to him, Oliver Sacks is very kind. And he says, well, what brings you, right? He doesn't just jump on him and say, hey, whoa, what's going on with you? He says, what brings you here? And the guy says, well, people tell me I lean. And Sacks said, but you don't think so. He said, well, if I were leaning, I think I would know it. But everybody insists. So then I decided maybe I should come to the doctor. So that open-mindedness is beautiful. But look, he still can't register it. So Sacks says, let's make a video. This is the old days with a camcorder, right? I got a video recorder here. It was fancy to have a camera, right? And so he says, let me film you and then we'll both look at it. So he films the guy. The guy looks at the footage and says, I really lean. And Sacks says, yeah. And something in there is not letting you realize that you are. So the first step, though, is he had to see it. Now, for most of us, a lot of our habits that are interfering with reality and creating these abstractions, like I think this is an upright action. We use that word for being upright as being a good person. We say he's a real stand-up guy. That's what we mean. A lot of the things that interfere with that, we can stop. We don't need to have a special intervention like this guy had to. And it was clever because he was a sort of handicraft kind of guy. He built a pair of glasses with a little pendulum in them so that out of his peripheral vision, he could see if it was level. So he created an intervention for himself. For most of us, we can just see the thing we're going to do. Like I see him about to get angry and I can just say, you know what? I don't have to do this right now. I don't have to fall for this. So the first thing is beginning to notice our insanities and our abstractions, and then realizing we have the physiological capacity to tell those neurons, don't fire right now. Mm-hmm. We don't need to do this right now. So that's one of the first things that we can do. Start to see it. Realize that it's unconscious. Start to see it and begin to inhibit those patterns and say, I can do something else right now.
So much good in what you just said there. I'm going to love this conversation. Firstly, that statement that philosophy is the end of abstractions is so profound. And I don't say that for hyperbole. I think it's such an interesting way to think about it, especially when you contrast it with the typical view of it You know, I often think, I'll talk to people, as I'm sure you might as well, you know, the meaning of life type question. And so many people kind of roll their eyes at that. And like, why are you wasting my time? And to me, that always baffled me, because I'm like, what's a more important question? Like, how is that viewed as a waste of time? When even on a very practical level, it is literally driving everything, whether you recognize it or not, it's driving everything you do. So I think that sentiment is such an interesting one, and it kind of illustrates what you're saying. So I agree, right? I think the story is the right story. I think in some ways, what we're asking people to do is to see their blind spots, to use that term, which by definition seems impossible and should feel impossible in some ways. Like, how do I intervene? How do I see it? How do I see it? And it brings me back to another maybe philosophical question, maybe biological, maybe spiritual, I don't know. But what are we talking about when we say that, right? Who's seeing what? You used the term neurons at one point, and I don't mean to put a stick in the ground in this. I'm trying to make sense of it myself as well. Is it that we are this essence, the spiritual being that is there observing, and the neurons are firing and we're observing those? And obviously they impact us in how we react and how we act and how we speak and all those things. But there's some kind of center being that is us that's able to observe that and see it. Because if you think about it through a purely biological level, if we think of it just as we have this brain, that is our tool to make sense of the world and to see these things, it almost becomes like this sick, twisted game where it's like, well, your brain is the thing that's malfunctioning, for lack of a better word, in some ways, that's causing these issues that you have. But then you have to use that same tool to see it. And it almost, again, feels impossible. So I guess the question I'm asking in a long-winded way is, how do we see it? How can you see something that you're blind to? How can you recognize something? Is it outside interventions, as you said, where you need to bring in other people? But even in that, as we've seen throughout the world, people can tell, a million people could tell you you're standing crooked. And if you don't want to believe it, even that video camera, well, clearly something's wrong with the video camera. Clearly this is a conspiracy, right? Our mind can really be powerful in that way. What do we do with this tool that seems broken that we have to use to try and solve our problem?
Okay. I can lay something out here. It's going to take a couple of minutes, because you pointed to several things that are essential. One of the things that's essential is the question of values. In the wisdom traditions, there's a very holistic view about how you change. And one of the people who's the most brilliant in laying out the nature of the mind and how we understand it in its, let's call it, its encumbered and its liberated states. Okay, but instead of saying it's broken, it's encumbered or kinked, like the energy is not flowing through it the right way. And he's my favorite psychologist and one of my favorite philosophers of all time, and that's Buddha. Now, as a philosopher, I'm a philosopher, not a Buddhist. My job is to take care of wisdom wherever I find it. Buddha was a very wise person. It's extraordinary to read him. But anyway, he said the structure of your experience, this very structure of it, we could break it up into 8 pieces, which he famously did, but you could break it up into 3. And the 8 other pieces are in those. There's wisdom, there's love, and there's beauty. There's a famous book that I actually had a podcast episode about this where I critiqued it, because I think it's a bad book, but it's called Start With Why. It's by Simon Sinek. Mm-hmm. And the thing is that he doesn't understand. He thought he discovered this structure, why we do things, what we're doing, and how. He said, I discovered this. Well, look, Buddha was talking about this 2,600 years ago. And he would say the way you are talking about it is deluded, really. I mean, with all due respect, I don't know this guy. I'm sure he's a nice guy, but it's very important to see. Good people with good intentions can do very unhelpful and even bad things, things that cause problems. And why is that? Because before you start with why already started with you. Mm-hmm. So here's what I want to get at when it comes to the question of values. When you say, well, let's ask about the meaning of life, and people get freaked out. It turns out that's the immune system of the insanity, keeping them away from asking what's really important. Because here's what we know scientifically that validates what Buddha said. If I show you, let's say you're a smoker, I show you an article that details the risks of smoking. And this was a study that was actually done. And then I take a non-smoker and I show them the same article. And I independently, right? This is, you know, like you go into a room and they have you read this and then they just ask you some questions about it. You, the smoker, read the same article as the non-smoker. I ask the non-smoker, what did you think about it? And the non-smoker will say, you know, it's pretty clear that smoking is bad for you. What do you think people should do? Well, I really think they should quit. I mean, if you read this, you see, you know, the risks are serious. The smoker says, well, you know, I'm not totally convinced. It's, yeah, I mean, maybe, but how do I know it's going to be true for me? And these scientists, they could be biased. They have all these issues and they're not convinced by it. Then you do a simple intervention with half of those smokers, right? Because it's the way you run these studies. You know, group A is one group, group B, and you don't know what group, you don't know what the study's even about. But in one of the groups, they, before the smoker reads the study, they say, okay, we're going to have you do something. Before you do, we just want to get to know you a little bit better. Can you reflect on what you think life is really about? Can you maybe list one, two, or three of the highest values that you have, what you really think you're living for, and just write a little bit about each one of them. Now, most people on reflection have really workable values: love, family, community, learning, knowledge, however they might express it. They fall under those three categories of wisdom, love, and beauty, right? If you say love is the most important, that's obvious. But if you say family, kindness, that's all under love. Art, creativity, that's all under beauty. Knowledge, learning, that's all under wisdom. You can group them under these three. It turns out that the set of values for the whole world is not as diverse as we might think. We might think, oh my God, there's so many cultures. People must have values that are way. No, there's a few dozen. And they really overlap and they can be grouped. Very few people will say upon reflection, what do you really think matters? What do you really want people to think you're living for? Very few will say fame, money, power. Some will, most will not. Now, if you get people to reflect on their values and they read that same article and you ask them now, what do you think about it? They are more likely to say, you know what? I think smoking might be dangerous and I think maybe I should try to quit. That shows you the importance of thinking about what your values are, and the culture does not want you to do that because most of us don't have the values that would keep this culture going. What are they? They're obvious. It is money, power, fame. That's the values that the culture by default convinces us that, oh, you're human. That's all you are. You're competitive, self-interested. These values group into two. There are self-enhancing, extrinsic values. Money is an extrinsic value. It doesn't have value in and of itself. And it's something that is self-enhancing. As I get more, my ego can get bigger. Power is the same. Fame is the same. Then there are self-transcending, intrinsic values. Love, we feel, is intrinsically valuable in and of itself, and it forces me to transcend myself. I don't get to enhance myself because I love you. That love is something that forces me to go beyond the ego, beyond my self-centeredness. And it turns out that when one set of those values, it doesn't matter which ones you have, okay, it could be knowledge, it could be whatever, goodness. When one of them gets triggered, the other one gets inhibited. Moreover, when fear gets triggered, you go to the side of the self-enhancing extrinsic value unless you have a way to stop yourself. So let me give you an example there. They get groups of people that they have them fill out this, you know, they do some task that is actually not the real task, but they're just given this, oh, fill out this questionnaire. And then afterwards, they're offered a treat for completing it. Now, before that, the task involves, this is the real trick to it, is that one set of people is reading and responding to an article in the news about how we're planting more trees, let's say, just something positive. The other group reads about how the Muslims are coming to get you. The Mexicans are going to take your job. The borders are insecure. They read something that is scary. And they have them fill out the questionnaire. And then they say, now, do you want a treat? Now, there's like a bowl of total junk food there. Then there's some fruit. If you read the scary article, you are more likely to eat junk food, even if A, you say you don't really think that's good and you try to avoid it. And B, you're not even that hungry. Because some people will say, I'm not hungry, but more people will eat if they're scared, and more of them will go for the crap. And that's because their real values of well-being, health, I love my family, I don't want to eat bad food for the sake of them, those values can motivate a change. Final example, there are some people who are perfectly happy to say, hey, I value money, I value power, I value fame. That's what I'm here for. So a group of researchers found some of the highest testing people on those. So these are the people who are really proud to say, this is what I'm in here for. And then they took them into two groups. The first group, they just had them reflect on those values. And then they showed them different news items, you know, like orphans in India, starving people in Africa. And they asked them, what do you think about this? If you were just really into these self-enhancing values, you say things like, well, you know, that's just how people live there. That's just how it is for those people. It's got nothing to do with me. If you take, this is the intervention they did, they took some of those people and they said, look, we understand those are your values. We're not going to try to change your mind about it. But could you reflect a little bit on why people might value love, kindness, compassion, wisdom? Just think of a few of those and write about why somebody might value those. They go through the same values intervention. They are shown the same stimuli. They ask these people, what do you think? And that's really horrible. And maybe we should do something to change that. That's how powerful values are. And so they are driving us. And that's part of your question. Mm-hmm. The other part of your question, which goes to how we change. And then I'll try to make this a little shorter because that was a lot. And I appreciate you said that.
Good stuff.
The other part of it is, okay, one, the culture wants you to think that you are an atomized individual and that you are a brain. In fact, this is one of the dumbest things going on in my view right now. I mean, okay, it's not 100% bad, but nobody changes by pressing on their reticular formation. You can't lead a group of people by flicking their, you know, ventral striatum. We don't operate a brain. We only have a mind. And that's why the wisdom traditions are so valuable, because they have been working with the mind. You don't have any awareness of your brain. In fact, that's what's called the explanatory gap. Is that I don't feel that I'm a bunch of neurons. I can't feel neurons working. I've got no sense that neurons are driving me. I do have a mind. I need to know what that mind is and how it functions. That mind, if it's truly relational, it means I'm not even really atomized. It doesn't mean I give up my free will. But if you take two different seeds, let's say identical seeds, I don't want to say two different seeds, two identical seeds genetically, and you plant them in two locations, one high on a mountain, another one down in a valley, you're going to get two plants that look so different, you're not going to think that they were genetically identical seeds. I have a podcast episode about this. There's a big Harvard study, the Grant study, 80 years, this study, over eight decades. And what they found is, if you want to, and so the Harvard study started by taking three Harvard classes. And I think it was a class of 38, 39, and 40, or maybe it was, I can't remember what the classes were, but I think it might have been. So it's been running since 1938. JFK was one of the people in this study. So these were Harvard men who went on to do the kinds of things that Harvard men do. And they wanted to know, well, what are the factors that explain why this guy who went to Harvard made twice as much money as this guy who also went to Harvard? They had about the same IQ. They had the same educational advantages. They're both going to Harvard. Come on, how do we explain, why does this guy make twice as much money? And what does it come down to? This guy had a warm childhood. The relationship that you have with your mother, it affects your IQ, your income, your health. It affects things all the way from the time you're a child to the time you're 85 years old. Your whole life. Now, we don't want to hear that in the U.S. because I need to be able to blame you if you didn't make as much money as I did. And I need to be able to say, well, I'm a little smarter than you are. I'm a little more creative. I'm a little bolder. I took bigger risks. The fact is that the ecology affected me. Now, it's not determinism. And I'm not saying there is nothing we can do. I'm saying that if we are relational beings, we need to understand that that's part of how we change. We need to change our ecologies and change how we relate with each other. This is why way back 2,600 years ago, when Socrates was talking to young people, and when Plato founded the first school, really like the first university in a way, those people all went away from their social groups and hung out with Plato. The people in those philosophical schools, they hung out together, they dressed differently in some cases, they ate different foods in some cases, and they gathered in their own ecology, their own little garden. Because if you want to change the fruit, you need to change the orchard. You know, if you wake up one day and the apple says, why am I an apple? Hey, you're in an apple orchard. That's really likely. The culture that we have right now is really good at producing the fruits of trauma, anxiety, depression, loneliness, greed, burnout, stress, strain, all of that. If we are seeds, if we were put in a different ecology, we might have a heck of a time producing this kind of fruit. Okay, but that doesn't mean there's nothing we can do. We can also do things. We have to learn what our mind is, how it works, and how to begin to notice the patterns of insanity and how they work themselves through us and do something different on the basis of our values. Because we will, there's one thing when we claim, is the values you claim and there's the values that you live. That gap is our problem. Most of us have workable values. Again, there's a minority who might say, I want money and power. Most people want love, community, family, and we're not living. And that's part of what makes us crazy. If you're not living your values and you know it, something in your soul is saying, no, 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 this is no good. Okay, so that's the general picture.
Oof, all right. So I tend to think of things on a first principles level, because I think very much in the spirit of what you're saying, to make this something that people can actually use and do something with, for at least some people, myself being one of them, we have to understand it at its root. I need to be able to trace it back and understand what exactly is it that we're saying, and then kind of it all flows from there. So what do I mean by that abstract statement? So throughout that, what you were just saying, there's this sense of like, take the seed and how it grows. There's the seed and its impact, nature versus nurture, I guess, is ultimately what we're getting at in some ways. But what I often wonder on a very philosophical first principles level is, what is it? Are humans inherently naturally self-centered, self-driven, looking to survive? The reason for that drive to power, fame, money, all those things, that's inherent in who we are. And it was inevitable that as a culture, we got pulled in that direction because that's us. As we've evolved, literally and figuratively, we've gotten this ability, whether it's been given by God, the universe, or randomness. This consciousness has allowed us to look at that and say, you know what? That's not what's, at least for some of us, that's not what's best for us. And I want to be different. I want to evolve beyond that base form and be something better. Or is it the converse of that? Is it that at our base form, we actually are this beautiful, loving, you know, creative, harmony-driven thing that culture has just pulled us away from? If it is the latter, where, and I think in some ways, the way you were explaining it, it's more that, right? The culture, the environment, the seed being planted where it was, that's created this issue that we have. What created that though, right? Because that starts to almost, there's like a multi-layered aspect to it. There's the current humanity that lives and there's culture. Culture in and of itself, you can almost view as its own entity, its own organism, that it's made up by people. So somehow people got to a place that created this culture that's now, in how we're talking about in this conversation, poisoning us. Why? Why did we get pulled that way if it was never meant to be that way to begin with? Why couldn't we just stay true to the beautiful, great things that we are? Why do we have to overcome all of this? Like, that makes some people, I think that's just the natural nature of humans. That's who we are, and we can't get away from it. I'm not saying that's true, but how do you think about that?
Yeah. So I like that we're going to first principles. And when you mentioned that, it reminded me about your question of how we can be concrete. And in case people didn't notice in the last bit of discussion there, the idea is that one of the things you can do to begin to change is to sit down and ask yourself, what do I really want to live for? What do I want people to think that my life was about? It will begin to change you, because you'll start to see that you're probably not fully in accord with that. Now, this question is an old question. Are humans inherently good, inherently bad, or neutral? And different philosophers have given different answers. One of the things that I like about here shows you a funny way that the immune system of insanity works, because we got this idea that in the Bible, it says that we're originally bad. Mm-hmm. It's funny because that shows you context. You could read the same story and say, no, you were made by the divine. Originally, you're good. Sure, you can make a mistake. But the idea of original sin, we twisted into thinking we're originally sinful, rather than, no, that just was the first sin. It was the original first sin. Your true nature is divine. It's good. It's sacred. And Buddhist philosophy has that same view. Platonic philosophy has that same view that we're basically good. If you have a philosophy that says you're basically bad, that's problematic. And those philosophies don't seem to succeed, because what do you do with that? Then there are philosophies that say, yes, it's context dependent, what comes out, you know. Mengzi, the Chinese philosopher, believed that the sort of basic seed is good, and then it depends on where you plant it. His idea of these, he had the idea of sprouts. Okay, now, in our contemporary culture, we twisted this so far that we had this view of ourselves as homo economicus. The homo economicus is inherently that it says human, we're not homo sapiens. No, no, no. We're homo economicus. And that being is self-centered, violent, aggressive, looks to satisfy its own needs and to maximize them on the basis of rational procedures. And that's that being is really like a psychopath. And I sometimes say, you know, if you, one of the reasons why economics is so complex and mathematical is that if you put that into plain language, you would see that it's telling you that you're a psychopath, and you would realize that this is a stupid science. Why should I believe that I'm a psychopath or a sociopath? Now, here's the funny thing. The research, we have the word compassion in the dominant culture, but it's the Buddhist philosophical and psychological tradition that developed an actual practice of compassion. It's one of the reasons why I think Buddha was such an incredible genius. I think to myself, look, this guy invented this thing 2,600 years ago. Now, in the 21st century, we're sticking people in brain scanners and saying, that really works. And it really does something. That's the second thing, actually, that I would tell people to do. If you want a concrete way to begin to change your life, we can put a link in the show notes or whatever, but you can go to my website. I give you free downloads that explain what compassion practice is. So instead of start with why, I say start with love. Mm-hmm. Reflect on your values, yes. So there's a way in which you start with why, but really the practice is I have to find that compassion. Now, the reason I'm mentioning compassion, though, it's incredible. There's a lot to say about it. But what happened in that research is that they showed that human beings can operate on the basis of compassion and perform better than people who are operating on the basis of self-centeredness. So the very things that homo economicus is supposed to do, like, for instance, be more rational, people trained in compassion practice are more rational in the same games that the economists would use to prove that we are self-centered. So it is called an existence proof. If I can show you, here's a real human being operating on the basis of compassion and doing better than someone who isn't, that proves to you that we, A, don't have to be in that state, and it doesn't work, and it's changeable. So that's really the most important thing. We can have all kinds of arguments about what we are and what whatever, blah, 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 but we are not inherently self-centered and aggressive and violent. Of course, there might be energy of a certain kind of energy in us. I know there are some indigenous thinkers, for instance, who say, well, you do have to deal with the fact that there are these violent energies, and what our culture did was ritualize the violence. And I think Tyson Yonkaporta was talking about how he read, it was probably a white anthropologist who recorded it, but that one of the tribes in Australia, because he's from Australia, that if when they did the ritualized fighting, anybody you hurt severely, you had to take them to your home and care for them, feed them, dress their wounds, and you had to take care of their family while they were recovering. And he said, look, that gave them a way to get that aggression out, but it sure gave you an incentive not to go too far. If you've got to take care of this, the guy you hurt and their family and everything. So it allowed you to work with it. Different traditions, though, would there are other traditions that would say, well, it's not necessary that it has to come out that way at all. Like Buddhist monks channel it into debating each other. You know, okay. So there's lots of options. But the point is that we certainly don't have to be inherently, we can't see ourselves logically as inherently bad and inherently stuck.
I agree with that, and I should say I want to agree with that. But here's where I get tripped up a little bit still is, so if I don't say this, you know, tongue in cheek or flippant, like I buy what you're saying, you know, I to use that phrase, like I think what you're saying about compassion, I think the studies, as you've illustrated, the Harvard study, the various studies, it would seem to logically make sense that that is a better approach to living. From an evolutionary perspective, though, and I use that word loosely, I still struggle with how we got here then, right? Because if our natural state is at worst neutral, at best, we inherently do have compassion and love in us. We're not bad. if it is obvious through observation and seeing the results that it works better that way, what did get us to this place where the dominant cultural way is that? Is it, and this is where spirituality starts coming in, because you mentioned, you know, these aggressive energies that we have, or whatever energies we have. Is it just that somehow those got tapped into? But even that would say, well, but why did they win out? If they're meant to lose, right? If people that are using compassion are meant to be better off, more rational, all the things, how did we get here? I think that's where some people bring the devil in. They can't explain it. Yeah. It doesn't make sense. There must be some other being that entered in and intervened and caused this. Is that how you see it? Or how else logically do you explain that there's a better way to live, yet somehow we still ended up here?
Yeah, no, that's I really am glad you asked that again, because I acknowledge that I wanted to answer that part of your question, because I felt that in your original question and I didn't. So let's go back to that. No, that's good. Really good. Okay. Yeah. No, so here's the thing about that. There are a few things to say about it. One is that clearly even in nature, one of the best examples that I see of this, now nature is difficult, what we say nature, where this is part of our problem in the dominant cultures. There's humans and there's nature, but we are nature. So there's a non-duality of nature and culture. Even that word culture, I mean, why is it, how do you have, let's look at the example of Yellowstone and the wolves. Mm-hmm. The caveat that I was going to say, though, is that given that human beings have trampled over so much of the world, sometimes we have to be cautious about what we see, because we don't know, would that be like that if we hadn't screwed everything up for these beings? We got rid of the wolves in Yellowstone, which, I mean, it's horrible what people did to this being. Really, really, like, it's a burden of guilt that we carry as much as any other bad thing that we've done. So they brought the wolves back. And what they found is that even everything changed. The whole thing, trees were growing where there weren't trees. The river changed its course. Populations of birds increased. Birds, what does that have to do? Well, it all goes together. And what was keeping that together was wolf culture, because they have a culture. Now, one of the most famous wolves, who was a being that I feel like, so obvious, you can see that there are very enlightened non-human beings. If you read about Wolf 21, Wolf 21 was like a superhero wolf. This guy never lost a fight, never started a fight, took on up to 6 other wolves at the same time, and never killed anybody who challenged him. He put them down, okay, to the point where they say, okay, that's I'm beat. He never killed any of them. Now, he had two partners. The partner who was really running the pack at first was Wolf 41. She was basically a psychopath. I mean, she was mean, aggressive. She killed her sister's babies. Eventually, they turned on her. His real love, and the reason he joined the pack, is from the human observation, as far as I could tell, was Wolf 42. She was like him. She was kind. She was nurturing to her fellow wolves. And the way he lived shows, okay, there are some wolves that might not be in that state. There are some wolves that are more like that, cooperative, collaborative, not interested in killing people. If, you know, unless you really have to, you got to hunt. That's one thing. And his line, the researchers showed this, that if you really think about it, the only way his line survived was because he spared the wolves that he did. That it can kind of show that in his line. Like, he spared this wolf, and because of that, Wolf 21's lineage continued. Hmm. So one of the answers is that there is variation, and under the right circumstances, if the wrong person gets in charge, you could now have a cultural shift. There's a second related thing, is, and it seems to me that the more resilient, beautiful, incredible states that we're capable of, unless we're totally enlightened, okay, which seems to not, that you don't come out of the womb enlightened. Buddha didn't come out of the womb enlightened. He had to go through all this stuff. But in general, even if you have a culture where people are just far more mature and advanced than we are, and you see this in anthropologists. So there was an ecologist, Paul Shepard, who argued that in the dominant culture, we don't become adults. We become aging juveniles. Now, I always say it's easy to point at Trump or Biden and say, yeah, you know, look, but he's saying, no, that's you. You think because you pay your mortgage and you're a generally nice person or something that, you know, and you're raising a kid yourself, that you're an adult. And he's saying you wouldn't be classified as an adult if I took you to the Paleolithic. And it's not because you can't start a fire with sticks or something. These people would just say you're not an adult. You don't know how to hold yourself together. Your mind's not clear. And there are anthropologists who have experienced this. Richard Sorensen is one. He said, you know, it's a beautiful line in his account of going into the Andaman. And he said, well, you know, I was put with the children and that's where I belong. He said, I was not an adult in this society. These people were more emotionally mature than I am. And I've got a PhD and I think I'm an adult. So I'm saying that even in, so in those state, those kinds of cultures where people are, they're not necessarily totally enlightened, but they're just much more cooperative, collaborative. And he was, Sorensen's writing is really worth reading because what he talks about, I mean, he describes things that they would look like they're coming from a Marvel movie script, the way people can use their bodies and interact with nature, and but it's just people. So here's the thing, though. He said that he saw, as the dominant culture, this was back in the 60s in a remote place, and so these people were still quite indigenous. And he said he saw the dominant culture patterns move in. And he saw how it destabilized people. They became alcoholics. They became violent. He said watching this was like a terrible gift, you know, that like, I see how this is happening. And I really, it's so tragic. But thank goodness I saw it, because now I can try to tell people this is what happens. The way I sum up that is that these more healthy states of being are highly resilient, but not stable. That means when things happen to those people, they don't necessarily get traumatized. They have a stronger mind. It's resilient. But if it gets destabilized, now it's gone. It didn't really have the stability. Whereas our culture, the dominant culture, our states of mind are stable, but not resilient. They're hard to break up. Okay, they're stable. You're stuck in it, but it's not very resilient. We're reactive, we're prone to violence, depression, anxiety, all the rest, all the things that we talked about, addiction. I mean, even addiction is a social phenomenon. Bruce Alexander showed that with his experiments. And of course, you might have heard about people from Vietnam who were using heroin in Vietnam. It was easier for them to quit once they left Vietnam. People thought, oh my God, what are they going to do? They're addicted. Well, once they came back home, they weren't in that ecology that produced the addiction. Okay, so I hope that's a little bit of an explanation. So there's some variation. Part of it, the answer is, look, there's variation. There are political and cultural and ecological circumstances, like a famine could destabilize the culture enough. And then those states that are better, they can be destabilized. And then they just kind of fall to the wayside and people start saying, well, it didn't used to be like this. And then we lose it through cultural memory. States we have to cultivate. And that's the other thing. So it's a final thing. I'm sorry. But the highest states we have to cultivate, and we have to recognize here too, the dominant culture, healthier cultures have invested lots of resources in states of consciousness that are not like the one that we're in mostly. Mm-hmm. So there were rituals, there were ceremonies. People learned to meditate. They learned to work with medicines, psychedelic medicines. We marginalize that. And that's also part of how that stability. You can get drunk, you can get buzzed with caffeine or cigarettes. That's it. We don't want you meditating unless you're going to use that to steal more money or something. Like, you know, a hedge fund manager, sure, you can meditate a little bit. Don't try getting enlightened. But that's a part of how it happens, is that we're not engaged in the practices that keep that better mind going or help you discover it and, you know, open up new possibilities. So that's part of the story too.
It's such a fascinating explanation to it, and particularly the resiliency versus the stability piece of it. Is it underpinned for you in a belief that, because some of what I hear as you're saying, that at least what it makes me think, is that the time perspective. It's very easy, obviously, for us as individuals, nevertheless, as just a human species, to assume we are significant in the grand scheme of time. But when you look at our culture, it's very easy to look at it and say, like, look, this is what we are. This is what humans are. Maybe this is a blip. Maybe this is one of those periods where the stability of the dominant culture is taking effect, but over the grand scheme of time, you'll see the enlightened culture win out. Do you have that faith or optimism or whatever the right word is, that it is that over time, this will play out, quote unquote, the way it's supposed to, that there's some perhaps driving force behind it, or maybe there's not. Maybe it's just exactly mechanically as you've been explaining it, this just works better. And over time, that's going to prove itself out. Or is there danger that, like, if we don't cultivate this, if we don't do it right, there's nothing that guarantees us that it will?
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's a big and heavy question. It seems to me that some people really believe that it will over time work itself out. And there's a different, I mean, there different traditions have different views on this. One way to look at the situation we're in is as an initiatory rite, where humanity itself is going through a rite of passage. And there are different people who have talked about this. Richard Tarnas, I think, has talked about this, and some other people. But the idea is, in an initiatory rite, there was a real risk of injury or even death. And they, you can't lose too many people, right? But that's part of what made it a real, there was a real risk. It was a real rite of passage. And so it could be that we don't make it through this rite of passage. Now, on a very cosmic, big cosmic scale, it might be that that's okay too, right? We can, it's a very difficult razor's edge to walk sometimes, to have, be in touch with the ultimate and not ignore the relative. If we're too much like, well, it's all good, it's all love, it'll be fine. Yeah, but people are dying right now and they're suffering right now. We have to walk that razor's edge as best we can. Otherwise, we will, I think it can be too much pressure even. That too is why we need the compassion practice, because one of the things that happens with compassion practice, when we're caught in, because we're relational beings, we're very empathetic. And that's why if you yawn, I'll feel like yawning. Where they play laugh tracks to sitcoms, because when you hear the laughter, you're more likely to think the joke is funny. If we see suffering, it doesn't matter, it can be in a cat, it can be in another human, it can be an adult, a child. When we see that suffering, something in us feels it like it's our own. So empathy is our basic capacity for this resonance. Without training, that's all we've got. And that is not enough. Compassion allows you to have a broader perspective so that you don't go into what's called empathic distress. We see this in care workers, nurses, hospice workers, veterinarians. I often point out that's that profession of a veterinarian, one of the highest suicide rates of any profession. In fact, sometimes it comes out as the highest. Why? They're seeing all this suffering, beings who can't even communicate with you. And it's, you get burned out. You really get burned out. If you're destroying ecologies and you're going against your own values to do it, something in you just doesn't feel it can look at that. I don't want to hear about what's going on in Africa. I don't want to know. And compassion shows you that you have the strength to look at it, that you can do something about it, and so on and so on. It really gives you that strength to turn toward your own experience and recover from that reactiveness and empathy distress. So without that, we won't navigate this very well, I don't think. I mean, we could have, you know, big catastrophes. I mean, we're already seeing it, aren't we? The heat waves, the people don't want to admit, or, you know, the pollution, there's plastic in your blood, there's lead. I mean, these things are causing real problems. These endocrine disruptors are probably part of why there is so much gender dysphoria. I'm not saying that there might also be, sure, let's acknowledge that it's possible. Somebody comes out of the womb and they think, hey, I'm not in the right body. It's not like that's unprecedented in human history. But maybe some of this is endocrine disruptors. And maybe, I mean, there's links to autism there in the science. It's not like I'm not trying to marginalize anybody. Yeah. I'm saying, okay, you are the way you are. We want to take care of you and honor you. But we can still ask, is there a reason why this is happening? Mm-hmm. It's the same thing with violent crime, right? We've seen some of that data that if you are in a neighborhood where the houses are more likely to have lead paint and there's more likely to be lead in the soil and then in your home, you're more likely to end up in jail. And it's just the same sort of thing. It doesn't reduce us to, oh, we're just brains, but yeah, we're relational. Mm. Okay, so that's some of the answer, maybe.
It is. Well, the answer is such a funny word because, you know, do we ever know the real answer? But I think that illustration there, Nikos, illustrates what we were talking about in the beginning of philosophy and kind of that contrast of what it is versus what people think it is. You know, what you're trying to do, it's the first principles concept. It doesn't assume why it is. It doesn't marginalize. It doesn't dismiss. But you can imagine somebody saying like, it doesn't matter why people feel like they're a different gender or they're more violent or more, whatever it is, right? We just have to deal with it. But it does matter why. Like understanding if it is the lead, if it is the plastic, if it is God, whatever it is, we should want to know why. We should try and understand it because that's our best way to move forward. Does it give us a clear answer of exactly this is how we should act? No, but I think it ties to what you've been saying throughout this conversation of cultivating that compassion. I would argue also there's a degree of self-awareness, ability to kind of see yourself, to understand yourself in a deeper way. All of that comes from this practice of saying, I do want to look and try and see what's here. I do want to understand why certain people react this way in this study. I do want to understand the meaning of life. If there is like all this stuff, it's all relevant because it all does impact us, our culture, our society, the suffering in the world. It all comes through it. And I'll say, Nikos, as we come towards the end here, like I mean this quite genuinely. I've said it before, but I mean it every time. I'm sure we could talk for probably 8 hours and go through all of this. And honestly, I'd love to do that because these are the conversations where I think, you know, there is a thread through them, but we're kind of letting it go where it goes, but we're just trying to understand. We're trying to make sense of it. And I think people like you who have the ability to blend, choose the word, right? The spiritual, the intuitive, that aspect of it with the scientific, the more mechanical, the more rational, and the more logical. That's what we need, all of it. We need all of it. We need to be able to look at all of it. And there's not many people, myself included at times, that can do both. So I think the work you're doing, the podcast, and there'll be links to all of it in there. This conversation is such an important conversation. It's such an important approach if we're going to figure it out, if we're going to start to cultivate that more. And that doesn't mean that you have all the answers or I do or anybody does, but it's the mindset, it's the approach that we're bringing to it. And I can't thank you enough for it. I really, really appreciate it.
Yeah, well, thank you for sharing these conversations. This is what we need. We need to have deeper dialogue so that we can let the answers think themselves through us. Because that's one other thing that I meant to touch on, and I'll just make this a final thing, that sometimes when I think about the idea of sin, I think, well, it's quite egotistical for you to say, I'm a sinner. What happens is sin, you become an instrument through which evil can work. So Elon Musk, he's just a vehicle of capitalism. He's not a capitalist like he's a, you know, visionary genius. It's not visionary genius to want to leave the planet that you're on that's perfectly workable to go someplace with no trees, no birds, no nothing. Stupid. But capitalism as a philosophy works through this guy. He's just a vehicle. When we're in touch with our highest values, wisdom, love, and beauty can begin to work themselves through us. We don't have to come up with the answers. We let those answers kind of come through us the same way that a composer says, well, I don't know where it came from, right? That's what we need. And through entering into these kinds of dialogues, we start to allow the ecology of mind to open, and then surprising things can start to come up. So that's it. And so thank you for having a space of sanity, cultivating it and taking care of it.
I'm going to quote you on that, space of sanity. Nikos, yeah. I love it. I appreciate it. As I said, I hope people check out your work, the podcast, all of it. I hope you keep doing it. I know I will keep following it. And I hope we get to talk again. I really do.
Same here. All right, my friend. Thank you so much.
Have a great rest of your day. Hey, thanks a ton for listening to the episode. I really do appreciate everybody that listens. And I think it's super cool that people want to hear conversations like this. They want to hear us talk about values and different perspectives and really just philosophical thinking. I'm kind of on this mission or journey to bring philosophy back to the forefront, maybe even make philosophy cool again. Because I just think there's so much value in thinking about our thinking, questioning and challenging ourselves more, pondering these big picture questions about life. So in that spirit, I'm trying to expand that mission a little bit, and I created a Patreon account that would be awesome if you check out. I'll put the link in the show notes. It's pretty simple though. It's patreon.com/whatsthevalue. And the idea is for people that maybe want to learn more about philosophy, dip their toe in it a little bit, or maybe you already love it and just want to get more of it. Check it out, because there's kind of a tier for everybody. Whether you just want to get like a quick philosophical video or a thought of the day, maybe you want to email or text me some questions and get some thoughtful philosophical responses. Or if you want to have a live one-on-one chat over Zoom, we're even doing group discussions where we kind of do group philosophical debates and discussions and ponder some of those big questions. So check it out. See if it's something you might be interested in. As I said, I just love to bring more philosophy into our lives, and I thought this might be a cool way to do it. Whether that's your thing or not, and you're into Patreon or not, I really do appreciate a ton that you listen and check out these episodes. So I appreciate it greatly, and I hope you have an awesome day.